We begin the hour by welcoming into the program our friend, the uber-talented writer Colin Fleming, to talk about some horror classics, the foundation of horror movies, Colin, and how very interesting and ironic that they were both made in the same year.
Yes, they were, Kimbo. 1931 is when these two bad boys, Dracula and, of course, Frankenstein, came out. They were both from Universal Pictures. And really, at this point in American cinematic history, you don't have horror films. you have films that look like they are horror films, and then at the end they give up the ghost, Waka Waka, and you find out the real human casuality behind the assorted goings-on. So this was like really the first time, unless you go back to things like Edison shorts from the turn of the century, where the entire narrative will be supernaturally based, supernaturally charged. And in the case of Frankenstein, we also have sci-fi horror going on there.
Now, both of these films also were adapted from stage plays. Did that have an impact on the way they were presented?
You'd think with the success of the Dracula stage play that had Bela Lugosi, and it was, I don't know, what was like comparable to now. I mean, like, what's the one that everybody likes that has its own chain of stores? The Hamilton, right? Mm. It was like that back in the day. And you'd think that would really give Lugosi an advantage to get this part. But the studio, they didn't want him. In the first place, they wanted Lon Chaney Sr., the man of a thousand faces and all that, but he died. And then there were like 10 other people that were favored before Lugosi assumed this role that has saturated popular culture, hasn't it? I mean, you can't, if any of us were to do a Dracula impression right now, it would come from this film, right?
Well, yes, even the Muppets, borrowed from Bela Lugosi for the Count.
And also Count Chocula.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Dude. And in fact, within Dracula itself, within the movie, there's the first ever Bela Lugosi as Dracula imitation. So I don't know if the team realized that this was a fun voice to do, or it just worked out. But it's in there. So it took a long time to get this into the film that we ultimately see, because there were attempts to monkey around with it. And at one point, not a lot of people know this, but one of the writers who was kicked off the project wanted to have Lugosi fly around in like this bat-shaped plane. He's like, we can tap into this like burgeoning industry. It'll be cool. He's in the bat plane. So maybe, I don't know, it influenced Batman or something like that later on. But it was quite the road to Transylvania.
Yeah, and Lugosi had to take essentially workman's wages here, $500 a week to play this part. And I thought it's interesting too, for a guy who had done it on stage, it's big and it's over the top, but also a lot of it is done very subtly, and Todd Browning really used a lot of close-ups with Lugosi.
Yes, and you wouldn't expect really as many close-ups in this film, because Carl Freund is he's the cinematographer, and he's a guy who preferred a moving camera. He has some of the most fluid pictures. He would of course direct. He's going to oversee the next year's The Mummy, and the camera moves a lot in that picture. And Freund was out of that German expressionist tradition. He'd come over from that milieu. And that's what he did. He moved the camera. He gave it that kind of fluid and poetic quality. But there are a lot of close-ups. And I think Lugosi was really well-served in this part because Dracula is a foreigner. One of the reasons, I mean, like the main reason, really, he doesn't let Jonathan Harker go, and this is especially true in Stoker's novel, is because he wants to pull everything out of his brain. He wants to try to acquit himself as naturally as possible in Western Europe, in London. He wants to have his run of the town. So Lugosi gives that, he's a foreigner in an English-speaking picture, and that clearly comes across. And like there's that scene where he's with Edward Van Sloan, and they're in like the drawing room, and they kind of have this stare-off that's prefaced by just a few words, almost monosyllabic words between the two of them, and such an intense scene And I don't know that you'd have that with, like, an English, like a Christopher Lee, for instance.
And, you know, we talk about the cast, and it's just a wonderful cast. I don't know if there's anybody, though, other than Lugosi, that created an iconic character that the people have felt compelled to copy ever since than the way Dwight Frye portrayed Renfield.
You know, I was thinking about Dwight Frye. If Dwight Frye was alive right now, he'd be the type of character actor that was on your show, right?
Don't you yeah, absolutely. Yes.
He'd be your kind of guy, I think. And he was like that scene where he's down in the hold of the ship, right? And if you sliced out that bit of the film and you put it into Murnau's Nosferatu, it would fit in. And that's like, in terms of terrifying images, you really can't beat that original version of Nosferatu. But that is just such a sinister image where he's mad, he's down below, you're looking from above at him. And it's in some ways a film that shouldn't maybe age that well, because it's creaky, right? The soundtrack is, you get a bit of Swan Lake at the beginning over the credits, which is such a creepy atmospheric effect. And then you're going to overhear a couple pieces, really, a snippet of some Schubert's unfinished symphony when they're all at the symphony itself. But the silence in the film is haunting. Like, it's like being in a dark house at night, some abandoned property, and you're like, all right, let's get drunk on natural light and explore this place. And you hear, and every single sound you hear triggers some fear in your mind. That's how this film works. And you're really not going to get that after 1931 with this whole cycle. So that really makes this version of Dracula stand out, is its atmospheric, auditory quality. It's like, we don't even need to do a soundtrack. Just let the natural sounds of what's happening here, of the crypt, freak you out.
And Todd Browning had, for directors, not a terribly long career, about 25 years, but man, what an impact he had going from Dracula in 31 to The Amazing Freaks in 1932.
Freaks, yeah, that is one where I wonder now if, like, you can, I mean, it was a horror film, and if you could classify it as horror. Now, the reason it's a horror film is because you have one group avenging itself on the people that had been there, the tormentors, right, the whole not one of us thing. But now I think people would try to reframe what Freaks is, people have probably never seen it, and say that it's about making fun of the handicapped and not everybody being bodily equal, whatever the term would be. But yeah, he Todd Browning was a dark guy who would go to places, the underbelly of the human experience, and he'd show you that. He had made a career out of these kind of grotesqueries, these physical handicaps with the aforementioned Lon Chaney and a lot of silent pictures. Now, if people don't know the chronology, it's like, this is the very advent of sound. You would not have heard sound in, like, 1928. Pictures were silent. So this was a big deal that now all of a sudden everybody was going to talk. And I think Dracula is so successful in part because it marries those two seemingly counter disciplines. And there were a lot of people who couldn't make that jump into the next era, right? So you have a lot happening with that. And Todd Browning, and people tend to look at this as one of his lesser efforts, like he was asleep at the controls. There is, for instance, a famous piece of stage dressing, or debated stage dressing, when one of the fair ladies is in bed and she's been bitten in the neck by Dracula, and there is what looks to be a piece of cardboard blocking to get out some of the light. Now, I remember being on a classic horror film discussion board. People were arguing about what this piece of cardboard was, if it was just left in there, for like literally 1,000 pages. So people get like pretty into this, but like, you drank a lot. I mean, it feels like everyone drank it. Like, if you were a film director or a baseball manager, you drank a lot back then, and that was definitely Todd Browning too.
And this is one of the first films too to take advantage of a very aggressive marketing campaign that highlighted the danger that people were passing out in shock, and, oh my goodness, make sure you're strong enough to see Dracula.
Yes, and it's funny because one of the ways that it was sort of foisted on the public, and I think we've mentioned this before, it came out on Valentine's Day. Happy Valentine's Day! it was like the romance that dares not name its name. You mean like the dead? You're feasting on like the living and kind of like blood-sucking based neck rape and all these other things that it's like, hey, baby, want to go out and like feel amorous later? We'll watch a little Bela Lugosi. And it is Bela. It always kind of bothered me. You know that Kink song, Celluloid Heroes? You'd think Ray Davies would know it wasn't Bela Lugosi, but it is Bela. It's always sort of nettled me. But yeah, that's how it was marketed. And then people would go and they would freak out. They would honestly freak out because there hadn't been anything like this. People freaked out when they first saw like slasher films, although we've become inured to that, and I think Dracula still works on us.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Now, I didn't know this until I was doing a little bit of research, that in the initial run of the film, there was an epilogue where Edward Van Sloan came out and addressed the audience directly.
Yes, he did, and that will be reprised at the start of Frankenstein, where he does that whole break the fourth wall thing. And he's like, look, this is going to be pretty scary. So, like, in terms of insurance and everything, don't say we didn't warn you. And it's showmanship, really. That whole line, don't say we didn't warn you, which is more or less what he says. You're like, oh, yeah, I'll double down. I'll show you, Edward Van Sloan, right? It makes you get into it. It makes you want to bring other people with you to get into it. So it's hammy, but it's an effective device.
Has anybody, and there have been some good ones along the way, but has anybody been a better Count Dracula than Lugosi?
I find it strange that, like, people tend to think that Christopher Lee was. And Christopher Lee, he looks this dashing part. He's really tall, but after that first Hammer Dracula picture, he doesn't really say a lot. He just has the red colored contact lenses. That's like his main thing, and he looks like a fetching Dracula. But Lugosi, he inhabits the character, and you couldn't approach him on set. Like, he was kind of a weird dude anyway, but he would say that he was Dracula, and you had to leave him alone. And of course, he's buried in one of his Dracula capes, and he actually reprises the role himself in, they had to not call him Dracula for contractual reasons, in 1935's Mark of the Vampire, which is also a Browning film. So no, I think when we say Dracula, we conjure Lugosi in our minds, and there are many people who were 15 years old, who were 25 years old, who have no clue who Bela Lugosi is, but they summon his image in their head. So I think that gives him the title.
The other connection between these two films, they were both produced by Carl Emily, who was ahead of his time. It was thought in a lot of quarters that full-length horror movies were not going to be commercially successful.
No, and we should look at Frankenstein, because that is the film that's one of the all-time best films. And Bride of Frankenstein has been one that has been touted as the best of this horror cycle. And the comedy really is dated poorly in that. And if you want to see how to put a film together, you can watch something like the way the creation scene in Frankenstein is edited. And I was watching it again the other day, and it's just virtuosic editing. You think like film doesn't have, unless you watch a lot of film and you read a lot of like film commentary, you think that it doesn't have rhythm. Just like sometimes people think that like words don't have rhythm. They think rhythm is a strictly music thing. But the rhythm of that creation scene is intense. It's almost like sci-fi / horror rhythm and blues. And then the way it ends, when you cut to Colin Clive, who himself was an alcoholic and died early, and he's just created this life as people look on, which is a brilliant sort of strategy for that scene, because we are also, the audience, looking on agog. And he utters that line, "Now I know what it feels like to be God." Even now, just saying that, it's like, wow. I mean, right? It's just one of the most dauntingly out there things that's ever been said in American popular art. So I think that also helped get Frankenstein into the culture. And It's the reason people conflate Frankenstein. When people say we say Frankenstein, a lot of people think of the monster, and of course it's not the monster. But the reason we do is because of Jack Pierce and that makeup, and of course your guy Boris Karloff.
Yeah, and boy, you can't say enough about the set, because it's so beautiful. The cinematography is incredible, and to me, and I love both pictures, but Frankenstein, forget genre, to me it's just a beautiful film.
It's a Baroque art film in some ways, right? It truly is. It's one of the staples of American, not like you said, not just horror, but cinema, like Ford's The Searchers, or it's one of those like sort of go-to pictures. And in that, the set, the laboratory set with the Kenneth Strickfaden equipment doing it is our cultural image of the mad scientist. Colin Clive is the mad scientist, but you also have this very human film of someone pressed against their will, something, into being what it doesn't want to be or deserve to be, and then having to adapt, make a go of that. I mean, it's a gut-wrenching film. And even the miniatures, like the mill, for instance, that's not like a real, when we see that exterior, that's just like a miniature on a table. The special effects, they hold up so well, and I think now we can see special effects where we're so conscious that it's computer generated. And you see the effects as such in Frankenstein, and you believe that that's how it was out in Bavaria or wherever this sort of in-between lost zone happens to be.
Now, Lugosi wanted to play the part of Dr. Frankenstein, but all along, apparently the producer, Carl Emley, thought he would be better off playing the monster, and eventually Lugosi decided he wanted no part of that, and I think the film gains by not having him, because Karloff added a humanity that made you care about that monster.
Lugosi thought of himself as an articulate guy, so he thought this was beneath him to have this. Essentially, it's a non-speaking role. Now, people will think that the monster talks, but you'd be thinking about Bride of Frankenstein. He doesn't really talk. He expresses himself through guttural instances in this film. So all of the acting is through that kind of wordless voicing and also the face. A lot of it, too, is the build. Karloff had a cadaverous kind of sunken cheek look to him that works well for, hey, I just plucked this body out of the morgue or off of the gibbet that was and Dwight Frye, like, you think of the opening scene of Frankenstein. It has like a number of like arresting beginning sequences where they're out there and they're robbing the grave, and Colin Clive, he's literally throwing dirt on the religious icons. Now, this was a different time in America. You would have seen this. It was like the Sex Pistols. It was like, huh? You can't do that, man. There was a lot of that. Then the sequence before, and Colin Clive's not even there, and we meet the rest of the family and the friends, and we see this photograph of Colin Clive as director James Whale, who's a different level of craftsman than Todd Browning. Like, James Whale is an actual past master. He's an auteur, whereas Browning really... He wasn't. He was a Hollywood man with a dark side to him. So you have this masterful technician. You have this, Edison is the cinematographer. He's just one of the best there's ever been. You have the editing team. And yeah, it adds up with the set pieces to something larger. It's almost like Dracula is this kind of folk art that survived. And this is like the sort of Sergeant Pepper, we recorded this properly in the studio art that survives. And last, but in a different way.
And I think of all the iconic scenes in the film, one of them that maybe doesn't get enough credit for making it such a classic film is the one that I'm sure must have absolutely shocked the audiences of 1931, and that's when the monster allows the little girl to drown after he tosses her in the pond.
He thinks so. They're sitting there, and she's floating these flowers, and she's a kid. She doesn't understand that what's going on here could be dangerous. And of course the monster, whatever you want to call it, doesn't understand, and so he really gets into this game of throwing the flowers, and he gives this girl a toss, and they have to keep doing this scene over and over and again until Whale was happy. So the little girl flew through the air a bunch of times, and he sees her, and she goes under. And it's not just that scene where the monster watches her drown. It's when her father carries her back to the village, right? That is, even any time you have a deceased child on screen, and now it's not just a deceased child. It's a deceased child being toted around, right? Like some kind of jerky or something like that. And it's just, again, you feel for the people involved. You even feel in a Macbethian way for Frankenstein himself, that this has gone further than he wanted it or expected it to go. So there's a lot. I'd say it's a pathos-replete film for all of the horror.
Has a better horror film been made in the years between 1931 and now?
In the States, I don't know that Frankenstein's been topped. I think there are a number of English pictures we can point to, but the critical consensus over the years has been that Bride of Frankenstein is the superior picture. And it starts out with a lot of scene chewing where Mary Shelley and Percy Shelley are just chomping away in these thick English accents and everything. And you have like this kind of like village idiot woman who is making all of these painfully bad jokes. And once it gets going, it's a great film. But I think Frankenstein is one of those rare note-perfect works of art. Like, I can't think of anything that you'd change about it. And perfect doesn't mean the best. Like, for instance, A Hard Day's Night is a perfect album, but Sgt. Pepper is not. Sgt. Pepper's a better album. It risks more. But I think there's a lot of risk in Frankenstein. It's horror films, they get shafted on these lists of top 100 films of all time and all of that because people get caught up in the genre. But this is a film that really transcends any notion of genre. So I do think it's the best American horror picture.
Well, a couple of greats that as many times as you've seen them are always worthy of another watch. I caught Dracula the other day, and Frankenstein will be coming up soon, I'm sure, for me. Colin, great to talk about both of them with you this afternoon.
Okay, thank you.
We'll catch you next week. Colin Fleming. Visit his work at colinflemminglit.com. Subscribe to the Many Moments More blog